we'll get started. I had a couple questions about default judgments, and I really don't want to linger on this long because we want to get into involuntary and voluntary dismissal and finish those today so that we can start cleanly on summary judgment motions. So I'll just kind of clean stuff up a bit because I had several questions after class. When you want a default judgment, remember you need a two-step process. There's the entry of default, which is not the end of the day. You don't get judgment. It's just sort of the indication so that the other party becomes aware that they might be going into default. And for entry, it doesn't matter what route you're going to take to judgment. This route's the same for all kinds of steps to default. You go to the clerk. You give an affidavit that says that the defendant has failed to plead or otherwise defend. And what constitutes failing to plead or otherwise defend? Well, the normal situation, failing to plead means failing to answer, all right? Otherwise defend is a little bit trickier. If you file a motion, at that point you're otherwise defending. Where it becomes you're no longer otherwise defending is when we've denied your motion to dismiss and then you don't do anything. So in that situation, you can still get entry of judgment. Doesn't mean you're going to get judgment, you just get the entry of default. So that's the first step. Once you get that, then you have to choose the path to judgment. If your case is really standard, it doesn't have any kind of twist to it that would require discretion, you can get the judgment actually from the clerk. And that's in 55B1. They spell out three considerations you have to meet in order to get the clerk to actually give you the judgment. The first is you have to have a sum certain in dispute or something that's going to be reduced to a sum certain. So that's typically not where people have injury damages. We talked about that. Because you can claim, I have $3 billion. And if you write it in your complaint, it doesn't mean, well, that's certain. It means that might be in dispute. What's typically certain? A loan for a set amount of money you were supposed to repay. Because there's really no argument about what that's worth. A contract which said, I would pay you XYZ for painting my house. You paint my house, I don't pay you that amount. It's not going to become something that we're going to say, well, really the amount was X, Y, or Z. It's in the contract. So it's really only those kinds of cases that you can go. The second consideration is that the person has failed to appear in any way, which means that they've made an appearance but are still in default, like wrote you a letter, wrote the court a letter, filed a motion and are just not doing anything, you can't go to the clerk for judgment. We're going to need to talk to the court and say, well, is this person really defaulting? Or maybe they've just kind of fallen behind on what they should be doing. Okay, so clerk, you can't go to that. Some certain, totally failing to appear. And the last one is the people we otherwise always look out for, incompetence and infants. So no minors, no incompetence. All right? Those are the easy ones. You get the clerk to give you the actual judgment. So it's entry with the clerk, judgment with the clerk. Most other cases, everything else, in most cases, go to the court because they're going to give you a hearing. So anything where the sum is not certain. So in our dispute, since it's an injury, a personal injury, we're going to have to go to the court if we want a default judgment. If they've appeared in any way, like they filed that motion to dismiss, but then you never heard about them from them ever again, we're going to have to be with the court. All right, a couple other just bullet point considerations. There are some people that appear but are still in default. How are they in default? They never actually answer. Once you get an answer, once you get a pleading, and then you stop doing stuff, you're not in default, okay? You're in sanctions because you're not dealing with discovery. You're in that kind of realm of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Really, we're talking about people who have motioned under Rule 12, motion to dismiss for whatever reason, and then just never actually get around to answering. Those are people who are appearing, but they're still defaulting. I wrote a couple other ways that you might find these kinds of people. Sometimes you have people that don't motion and don't answer, but still will be counted as appearing, so they'll get a little bit more protection. Sometimes people write, especially pro se people, will write a letter to the court, contact the court, contact you. If you've had any contact in any way, you should presume this person's going to be deemed to have appeared, but still be in default. And so what does that mean? Well, two things. For step two, we're going to have to go through the court. They're going to get a little bit more protection because they've done something. Other aspect is they're going to get notice of the hearing. That's 7 days of notice of the hearing in step two. So they can come and say why they haven't actually done this. The last two are why people are kind of asking me, well, why wouldn't you just move for default judgment if you can right away without even contacting the other side, is because they're going to be able to undo it for good cause. So the first thing is, if you get an entry, but before judgment, they can, under 55C, move to set aside that entry. And how do they do that? Well, they say that they have good cause, which is excusable neglect, or excusable neglect and viable defense. What would excusable neglect look like? What do you think? What would be like excusable neglect?
Why would you say reckless might not show up, but and we get a default judgment against him, but he might have a reason to get out? Any ideas?
Yeah.
It is the primary one you see, and how can you not be aware something was imperfect about the service of process? We set out to give good service of process, it didn't just happen. So it's one reason why you might want to call or give a certified letter before you move for default, because what's going to happen? He's going to come to court and say, I file an affidavit that the service was not given to me. What's the court going to say? No default judgment. Because we really want to get to the merits, and if that's really the reason, that's going to probably be excusable neglect. He was in a massive car accident. Maybe he's been in a coma this whole time. You don't want to be in court saying, I got my judgment, and he says, I was in a coma. They didn't even call my lawyer, you know. So it gives you just that buffer. That's why you don't go to it right away. It's why courts kind of get a little angry if you haven't even tried to at least determine. Now, that doesn't mean if the other side is not returning your call or is not moving, I'd even tell them, if you don't file within the week or within so many days, I'm going to be filing for default judgment. You know, you can be aggressive. It's not like, well, do you mind getting around to my complaint? But at the same token, you don't want to come to the court and not realize the guy's been not served, because that's going to be your problem. Okay.
Last part, setting aside default judgment. Same kind of process, but you're also going to need another Rule 60B. And we're going to come back to that at the tail end of our material, so we're not going to deal with that here. Just put it in your notes, because you're going to see it again. Okay? That's just kind of the catch-up on default. If you have any questions on that, just see me after class, because I wanted to get into involuntary and voluntary dismissal, but just wanted to make sure, since I had quite a few questions, your notes were at least, this is the bullet point you need to take away, and if you're good with this, you're good with default. That's really all it is. Okay, so 41. 41 has voluntary and involuntary dismissals. What's the big difference? A voluntary dismissal in Rule 41 is made by the plaintiff. And that might sound unusual, and it is.
But we'll talk about why they might want to do that. Why you yourself, as person's representative, might decide you want to dismiss your own case. So this rule allows you to do that. And it's voluntary because if a case is getting dismissed, typically the plaintiff doesn't want that. So voluntary dismissal is, hey, I'm actually choosing it. Involuntary dismissal is the defendant's kind of counterpart to default judgment. You know, they don't respond, they don't give us an answer, we move for default. You file your complaint, reckless answers, and then you don't do anything. So he's kind of hanging out there going, am I going to have liability? Am I not? They're not doing anything. Involuntary dismissal under Rule 41 is their counterpart, okay? For you just kind of going off the grid after we've started the case as the plaintiff. So let's talk about involuntary first, because that's often what you're going to see. It's pretty straightforward, but that's what you're going to see. Okay, so who files the motion to dismiss under Rule 41B if we're talking about involuntary dismissals? Mr. Bryson, who does this one? That's right, because it's involuntary, it's against the plaintiff. And what reasons does the court give us for the standard by which a defendant can say, you need to have your case involuntary dismissed? What basis can you argue that they should have their case involuntary dismissed? Under 41B. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's stop right there. Failure to prosecute, that's akin to default. That's what it is. It's just the language. Prosecuting doesn't mean criminal. It just means plaintiff, because you're trying to proceed with your claim of relief that you wanted. Okay, what's the second one? And what would these rules be? What do you think they mean when they say with these rules? What rules are they referencing, do you think? The rules you've come to know and love. The rules of... That would be it. The Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. So this is in violation of the FRCP, the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Meaning like you're pretty much just whole hog messing around with the rules. We're not talking about they violate one rule. Because if they violate, like let's say they violate the way in which you are supposed to write out your complaint, what would you do?
would you typically just pull the trigger and go, involuntary dismissal, they were supposed to put it in paragraphs and they didn't? Probably not. It's probably looking at more of like a full-fledged, they're not cooperating by the game we've agreed to. If someone's doing something wrong with their complaint, you have other ways to attack it. Where can we attack that? What other motions that we've already learned? Anybody? Maybe, probably not a sanction for the pleading. We might. What sanction for the pleading could we get? What rule do we learn? What? Rule 11's one way. Like, let's say they don't write a claim that's actually a claim. What can we do? Move to dismiss that claim. Move to strike. There's ways we can deal with violations of rules. Typically, what you're looking at here is, like, the level of failure to prosecute. I'm not playing the game we've agreed to. But this is the second way. What's the last way? Failure to do what? Right. Comply with a court order. And this is generic, but anytime the court orders you to do something, you haven't done it, that's a huge faux pas, and you can get involuntarily dismissed. Okay? The court really gets upset about that. So do the parties. All right? Remember, that's like the same thing we saw under sanctions for discovery. Once you get that order, the game changes. When the court orders you to do something, it's sort of like stand at attention. All right? So 41, just trying to bring that in. So we're talking big stuff. The other one that's not in there, but I'll tell you, is sort of implicitly in there, is any non-waived defense under Rule 12B. That if you still have those out there, sometimes you can argue that that's also a basis for involuntary dismissal at this point, because it operates like an early dismissal under Rule 12. All right. So sometimes you'll see cases like that. It's not in the rule, but some cases have permitted and cited Rule 41 when dismissing for what seems to be a ground under Rule 12. And why? Because these things typically happen early in the lawsuit. Could they only happen early in the lawsuit? Is there a time limitation on this? What do you think? Do you see any time limitation in there at all? Good. There isn't. There isn't one in there. So arguably, if they just all of a sudden stop later in the lawsuit, this could happen. But typically, we resolve those kinds of problems, like failing to answer discovery, under the discovery rules. So when are you usually going to see this? At the beginning. Think of it as the corollary to default judgments. Okay, very good. Now, if you get one of these, must the court dismiss or do they have any discretion? This one's hard because it's not in the rule itself. It's kind of have to, it's one of the read between the line parts of the rule. Do you think that the court has to automatically, if you give them a Rule 41 motion to involuntary dismiss, grant it? Or can they weigh it and say, well, maybe we'll keep this case? What do you think? Mm-hmm. Exactly right. It's not a must. Okay, what made you come to that conclusion? There's a lot of maze in this rule. That's perfect. Good. The other thing that I think is implicit here is, how does it come up? What do you have to do as a defendant? Move. And so if it's a motion, typically that almost always implies some sort of discretion. Not always, but a lot of times it does. And so I think all those things work together. We're really trying to see, just like in default, when we got the default judgment part by the court, we have a little bit of room of saying, should we reach the merits? Or should we just say, plaintiff, you haven't done a good enough job here. We just need to get rid of this case. Good. Example in your book about this is on page 708 link. We're not going to look to it, but they just cite, it's a small little citation that tells you a couple of reasons that the court might decide to go ahead and dismiss something. There they tell you, well, the plaintiff is causing unnecessary delay. Basically, what they were doing was being incredibly invasive with every request the defendant gave, very early in the suit. And they said, we've got congestion of our court docket. So it's generic, you know, because every case congests the court's docket. But what they're trying to say here is, it's just, you haven't done enough to really move forward. We don't think it's almost like a genuine claim. Is at what point would you, why are you stopping with no legitimate reason? Okay. So before we talk about what happens of the effect of the dismissal that's involuntary, I think it's important to just say that there's a certain terminology you're going to see, and certain words are used and they mean the same thing. Okay, so let's just use the terminology for the effect of dismissals. This will apply both to involuntary and voluntary dismissals. Okay, dismissal with or without prejudice. You're doing excellent. What does with prejudice actually mean? That's exactly right. That's exactly what it means. It means you cannot refile it.
What does without prejudice mean then?
That's exactly right.
That's all it is, really, is that once we mean with prejudice, we treat it as, and so sometimes you'll see it phrased this way, as res judicata, meaning as if we got a whole jury together and impaneled it and they just ruled against you entirely. So it has that binding effect going forward. That's what with prejudice means.
Without prejudice means we're going to give you another bite at the apple. It does not have res judicata effect. The other word sometimes we use to mean one of these is adjudication on the merits. What do you think that one's synonymous with? A with prejudice dismissal or without prejudice? If we call it adjudication on the merits, what do you think? Do you think that's with prejudice or without prejudice? When we use those words, it's a synonym. It means one of those. Without prejudice, that we have an adjudication on the merits? Why'd you say that one? Yes, let's be very honest. Okay, so let's break it down and use the words and then figure out which one it is. I'll tell you, it's with prejudice, okay? So adjudication, what's an adjudication? What does that word mean, adjudication? What do you think? For something to be adjudged, let's break it down. What does that mean? What do you think? Well, what does this sound most similar to? What does this sound most similar to? What's an adjudication? Any other word or piece of a word you might find in there somewhere else? Judah, that's right. Judah sounds like a judgment, right? So that's what it is. It's an adjudication is a judgment. That's all it means. It's sort of like, it's just that's what it is. Judgment. So judgment on the merits. Okay, when we reach something on the merits, it's typically like we went to trial. So because if we say it's like a judgment that we went on the merits, that we actually resolved the dispute, then it's with prejudice because it's as if we use the whole jury. So it's res judicata in the future. So when the rule uses adjudication on the merits, they mean with prejudice. It's the same thing. So don't think of it as, oh, it's a different standard or it's a different thing. That's what it means. Excellent job. All right. Let's talk then about what the effect for involuntary dismissals is, and then we'll move on to voluntary. Is it with prejudice or without? I'm going to finish this up, then you'll be off the hook entirely. Is this one with prejudice if you're involuntarily dismissed? Yeah, it is. So, and that's under 41B. There's only one little caveat in there, or two, one of which I'm going to give you because it's not the one I'm going to test you on. It's the future kind of class you're going to take. It won't be with prejudice if the reason for dismissing is they have improper jurisdiction, venue, or failure to join a necessary party. So, like the technical aspects of the court. There's another exception in the rule for when it won't have with prejudice, and when's that? I'm sorry, what? Exactly. So unless it states otherwise, what we mean here is unless the court says it's not going to be. So that means that while it's a discretionary decision by the court, it's also discretionary potentially for its effect. Now, our presumption is it operates as a dismissal with prejudice. On the merits, you can never refile. But the court can adjust that, and they do. Especially if there is some sort of dispute about whether or not there was a legitimate reason for the failure to prosecute. Okay? Yes?
Is this case with prejudice? Does that mean that the plaintiff can't bring it in any other court?
Okay. Yeah, because what will happen when you're when you learn in jurisdiction, the concept of res judicata means, let's say you do refile. You file in state court, you file in federal court, in a different court. The first offense they're going to raise is, this has been decided already, and that defense is called res judicata. And so you move to dismiss under the grounds of res judicata. And so no matter where you go, as long as the courts honor the jurisdiction of another court, they'll give it to you. And courts always honor the jurisdiction of another court. Federal honor state, state honor federal under the Constitution. Does anyone know where in the Constitution they have that? I know I haven't expressly told you this yet. I'll have to get your common law professor to tell you. Does anyone know where this is at in the Constitution? Yeah, we're getting close. Does anyone know what part it is? It's a nice clause. Anybody? So I'm hearing some whispers, and it sounds like it, but I can't tell. So I'm willing to... Starts with full. Visit. Full faith and credit. Full faith and credit clause. Any court's ruling is recognized by another court's ruling. You'll learn that there's certain times where we don't recognize other court's rulings. And I'll tell you what it is. It's when they didn't have jurisdiction or power over the decision. So it already seems like that's built into the rule. And it's true. They understand the law in other areas, so the rule kind of mimics what they already know to happen. That you're not going to ever have binding effect if it isn't given full faith and credit. When don't we give full faith and credit? When people were not given
due process because there was no jurisdiction or otherwise. Okay? All right, so presume prejudice. Court can specify without. That's involuntary dismissals. Any questions on that part? Yes.
I'm sorry, so what was the
unless? The unless the court specifies otherwise. So the order dismissing can say this is without prejudice.
Any other questions on involuntary dismissals? I mean, voluntary, we're going to go to voluntary next. Anything else on this part, though?
Okay, let's do voluntary. This is the one where the beginning part, I think, is not so tricky, but the end part is. So that's the forewarning. So we want to just move to this because I have hypos at the end to see the end part. So basically, this is voluntary dismissal, and it's voluntary because the plaintiff is seeking it. So in our dispute, it's Parsons. Parsons would be asking for this. Okay. Now, you may want to know right away, why in the world would a plaintiff want to dismiss their claim? Why would a plaintiff want to dismiss their claim? Anybody? Yeah.
Maybe they just...
Okay, so it may just be like, I want out of this forever. I'm sorry, I hate litigation. It might be that, yeah.
I think involuntary dismissal, because we're going to see it, it ends up often being the presumptive effect is going to be without prejudice. So what you're really seeking is to sue again someday. All right, so why would you do that?
They run out of money.
That might be a potential, yep.
If you've already blown your amendment to it,
okay, in some ways, there's sort of that reprocessing, repositioning your case. And so it might be for procedural errors. It also might be because you're starting to learn more about your suit, that the jurisdiction you pick, for example, you can't sue a new defendant you've learned about. And so you want to dismiss against those defendants and say, I'm going to refile in a jurisdiction where I can sue you at the same time. So you're going to want to think about this rule when you learn about the limitations of the courts you select. That's probably the most often one. There are other, like, just life issues, money issues, procedural problems, like, oh, we did this wrong. And that you have to keep in mind, because the courts kind of here and the rules are trying to balance a little bit of, you know, we want to give you some leniency to do things over because we're very early in the suit right now. But we also don't want the defendant to continually be, well, you're being sued. No, you're not. Yes, you're being sued. No, you're not. Yes, you're being sued. No, you're not. Because that's a lot of money each time you have to go and start something up. When we dismiss without prejudice, it's like the slate gets wiped clean. Those things that we've alleged, we can just restart. That's going to be our tension here. All right. But typically, that's why a plaintiff will want to do it, is so they can file in a jurisdiction that's more appropriate, having learned other things. What's still going to be limiting them, so you don't think processes open the world up to whatever they want to do, statutes of limitations. All right, so when you file in one place and then refile, since it's actually getting refiled, you still have to be within the statute of limitations. Now, in your when you're talking about the federal courts next year, you're going to find ways to move amongst the federal courts where you keep your case live. It's like going to be called transfers of venue. You can go, and you can sometimes even go between the state and the federal courts with some limitation. And you do that because you don't want to restart, because if you restart, you're already outside the statute of limitations. And relation back, nothing will help you because it's totally like a new case. You get nothing to come back to. It's like it starts over. All right, so you're still within the statute of limitations. You found something sort of defective about the place you picked, or something else is pressuring you, and you want to change it up. All right, so why? There are three ways to voluntarily dismiss. Okay, we're just going to kind of put a label on them and then come and talk about each one. The first one you're going to want to call notice dismissal. notice dismissal. The second is stipulation. And the third is court order.
Notice dismissal, stipulation, court order. Trickiest one that has the most nuances to it, notice dismissal.
All right, so let's talk about that one. All right, so Ms. Marissa, when does the plaintiff persons have an absolute right to dismiss under notice dismissal? If we look at that A1A, the first little I, that's our notice dismissal part. When could she do this? Good, and it is really limited. We're not talking about any kind of motion. We're only talking about motions for summary judgment and answering, okay? So before those two things, for reckless answers or before reckless files a motion for summary judgment, she has an absolute right to get notice of dismissal, to give it, and involuntarily dismiss her suit. So she doesn't have to get their permission, not recklesses, doesn't have to get the court's permission. It's kind of like the matter of course amendment to your pleadings. You don't have anyone else's permission required here. If she wants to do this, what does she have to file? Good. Just a notice of dismissal. That's all it is. You file it with the court, you serve it on the other side. That's it. And it operates as a dismissal. Why do you think we'd allow a plaintiff to do this? If you think about the limitations of when she can do it, that you've already told me, before the answer or a motion for summary judgment. Why would we allow a plaintiff to do this without even checking with the court or with the reckless? Why let persons do this? Okay, well, we can think about why she might want to. Maybe it's one of those things she wants to fix, a venue she wants to choose. But people might be getting upset, right? That they don't want to get jerked around to a different court. They don't want to have to restart their litigation. And so the rule tells us she can't do it at any old time, right? She has to do it before, you just told me, before what? Okay, so what are they trying to look at? Why make it a stop of you can do it on your own without consulting with anyone, but only before he answers or before he serves a motion for summary judgment? Why kick those kinds of things? What do you think? Let's think about motion for summary judgment first. Why might you say, well, after they've done that, you can't do this without either checking with the court or checking with reckless? Do you guys work on summary judgment motions in your legal writing class yet? Yeah? So, and you're doing it like fake can world, right? Without any other cases going on or any other clients calling every other day with their case being the most important thing in the world to them. All right? Can you understand why if you've done one of those and filed it, you might not want the plaintiff just to start involuntarily dismissing the case and going elsewhere where that has no effect? Yes, they have. They put a lot of work into it. So do you see the difference maybe between a motion to dismiss for Rule 12b-6 and a motion for summary judgment? We haven't talked about those, but I know you've started dealing with them, so you've had a little feel for it. There's a lot more work that goes into a motion for summary judgment than simply saying, hey, they can't state a claim. All right? And an answer. I know you guys didn't write one, but I can guarantee you if I just strolled over to the other side and asked, do you think you might want to have had this done before you wrote your answer? I think they would all say the whole, yeah, no problem. If I had to put the effort into deciding whether or not these claims had had validity and responding to each assertion in the complaint, I want to at least be consulted or have the court consulted before it gets yanked from the court. Yeah.
Does this have something to do, too, with the fact that the defendant hasn't really made an appearance yet? Either?
No, because they have.
Oh, okay.
Because if they filed a motion to dismiss, for example, in this kind of a suit.
Uh-huh.
Because you're not in the default range until you've gotten denied and don't continue to do anything else. You're in that otherwise defending range. But it's more along the lines of they haven't put a lot of work into it such that we would expect them to kind of throw their arms up in anger that we just allow this case to get dismissed without prejudice to be refiled at another time.
Okay, so that's kind of it. It's the balance between giving you a do-over and balancing the prejudice to the defendant.
All right, so let's look at it here. Plaintiff persons, we'll click in everybody. A's yes, B's no. Oops, I didn't pull up the clicker. Hold on 1 second. let's end the show and pull it up. Your hypothetical's from your worksheet, so go ahead and look at it. Plaintiff Parsons files and serves her complaint, then moves to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction. Can the plaintiff then move to dismiss by notice without consulting anyone? You can talk with someone, and you're going to click A for yes or B for no. It'll be up in just a second. It'll take 1 second. These things never go as quickly as I'd like them to. Alright. Oh, no. Sorry. I didn't realize I hadn't put that up. Okay. Here it is. A, yes, B, no. All right. There it goes. I should start putting your things in now. Pretty quickly. Okay, you got 20 seconds, so go ahead. Should already have this one. Okay, we have 64% saying yes, 36% saying no. This one is yes, all right? It's not as high of a number yes as I'd like to see. Let's figure out what we... For those of you who said yes, why did you say yes, since that's the correct answer? Yeah, Mr. Crump.
It's not an answer, and it's not a motion.
That's right. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Yes?
Oh, it's something else.
It's something else. It's one of those early motions for lack of personal jurisdiction. Is an early Rule 12 motion, so it doesn't count. So that's the answer. It's not an answer, and it's not a motion for summary judgment. Realize the rule is very precise there, because motions for summary judgment a lot more work than the basic early motions. Okay, they can file an involuntary motion to dismiss if you've just filed a basic motion to dismiss under Rule 12 for any of the reasons stated in Rule 12. Any questions on that? So it's about, there's almost like 40% with that one wrong. So does anyone have any questions on that? Okay. Well, let's look at the next one then. We're at A, yes, B, no. Plaintiff Parsons files and serves her complaint, then defendant answers. Go ahead and I'll give you 30 seconds for this one. You should know this one. Let's go for 100% or 80. I'm going to take it. It's Friday. You guys are working hard, I know. Not enough sleep going around universally, I know. It's all right. Okay, good. This one is a no. Why? Because he's answered. All right, very good. See, now we're going to have a really nice cumulative margin of victory coming up. All right, but that one's no. Okay, so what options does she have? Do you have as persons at this point if you'd like to voluntarily dismiss your complaint? What could you do? Is that it? You done? Yeah. Good. Anything else? Let's say Reckless doesn't want to do that. Yep. It's just those other two routes. Okay. So if you're thinking about it, you want to make sure this is sort of like a checklist in your mind. Am I in that automatic? I don't have to talk to anybody. That's the best place to be in if you really want to involuntarily dismiss because you can't get told no. But if you're outside that window, you have the other options. So for plaintiff, one of the first like issue spotter triggers is, am I outside the notice time? Meaning, have they answered or filed a motion for summary judgment? At that point, I know I can't go there at all. There's another reason you might not be able to go there, and we'll talk about it in just a moment. All right. So let's talk about the stipulation route. To dismiss by stipulation, who would Parsons need to get to agree to our dismissal? Ms. Venable? All the parties who have appeared. And here, realize an appearance can even be just entering an appearance, basically by writing a letter, all those little easy things you could do, even appearing to the court on initial status conferencing counts as appearances. All right, so who would that be in our case? Well, in your case, it's probably different, each one of yours, because some of you had different people sued. Reckless. Definitely reckless. And then for some of you who had, like, the coffee company sued, they might be also someone you also have to seek stipulation from. Why do you think we require reckless to agree to this? Okay, but the thing is, it's not like, we kind of have been talking around this, and I'll tell you, because we're getting to it, what's the effect of all these? It's all going to be without prejudice, which means what's going to happen? It gets dismissed without prejudice, and plaintiff's going to do what later?
Refile. So is it getting free of liability? Okay, so why might we want to still make reckless agree before we allow this to happen? Well, if you think about it, I know I've been thinking about it from Parsons' perspective for a long time, but I'm sure you've at least met some of the people from across the hall. If we just allowed you to decide, we're yanking it, I'm going somewhere else, it's a total mulligan, it's been great, let's restart, what do you think they'd say?
I don't
know. You don't think they'd like that? I don't think they'd like that either.
Yes.
Yes, it's prejudice to the defendant. And so if you're the defendant, why might you agree to this? Why would they agree to it? Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, you want to answer why they wouldn't? Okay, I think that's probably, go ahead. Why wouldn't they? Yeah, I think they don't want you because it's like the time in, it's like restarting everything that's happened, all the judgments in that case are really not there. Why would they want to?
Like give them more time to prep their case and find stuff otherwise.
Okay, maybe they have some advantage in it. Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay, there might be a reason to think that the court's going to allow for this. Yep.
Maybe Parsons doesn't even want to sue him anymore. She found out in her information that she needs to sue somebody else.
Okay, it might be that you're not thinking she's going to refile against you. Yep.
They settled.
Okay, but you're not going to want to dismiss without prejudice in a settlement. And a settlement actually is a contract. And when you settle, you write it up. And one of the things you make sure you put in your settlement is this releases your claim against me. You actually write those words and say, so this is with, then you say, this has been dismissed by stipulation. We do that. That's exactly what we do. We go to the court and say, we dismiss this voluntarily with prejudice. All right? You laugh. I had a colleague who called me one day, not long after we'd been in law school, and he was all excited to be in meeting this really, really tough case and come to a great settlement. I was like, oh, that's great. I can't believe we had to agree to that. I'm like, what were the terms? And he, like, stopped on the phone. He goes, oh, crap, I didn't get it writing. What were you thinking? So anyway, fortunately, the other side honored their deal, but just as we all chuckle, I think there's times you get wrapped up in a moment. So always as a lawyer, there's certain things you have to say. This is, I can't leave without it. One is the document, the other is their signature. And that's the part you missed. We're like, you know, oh, yeah. And as we were talking, I think it's done, and I'm like, he didn't sign what we talked about. Yes, from your question.
Well, I was just saying, people actually do that, like, thank you for sue you again.
Oh, if you don't get it released, yeah, they could, very much. But of course you would say that we've had the other thing though, it's, don't worry, you still have some aspects to it. Remember, there's a defense, an affirmative defense called satisfaction, right? And we've already given you some money. The problem is, if you didn't get them to release their claim and we settled for something less than the full amount of their damages, that's still up for grabs. So it's all like, you have to tie it with a bow. Nothing is sort of like, yeah, we're good enough, ever. So it's the meticulous that do well. All right, any questions on that part? All right, is there any time limit as to when we could do this, or can we get a stipulation up to the end? There isn't one, right? At any time. However, do you think it's likely that Reckless is going to agree to dismiss his case when we're close to trial?
I highly doubt it. Unless it's for prejudice. I highly doubt without prejudice he's going to do this. All right, so if we figure with stipulation, we don't put a lot of limitations on it because we figure out the parties who are opposing this have their own interests at play, and they'll do a good job of saying, no, I'm not going to agree to that. All right, so there's not a lot of limitation on it. Okay. The next one is court order. And so now the permission you're seeking is the courts. And what you do is file a motion for voluntary dismissal. And typically, I'll tell you, having worked at the courts, you generally file a draft order as well. Okay, but the motion is what you're required to actually file. What kind of terms does the court have when they actually decide to do this? The rule is very loosey-goosey. What were the actual terms in the rule for court order? I'll take a volunteer. Anybody on that one? Yeah. Yep, it's terms and condition the court deems proper. All right, so that's sort of like justice when we feel like it. It's very loose, okay? And that's intentionally because this time the court is getting the order, and it generally on these motions, if it's contested, it's likely to be denied, but you get a hearing. And so they want to kind of leave it open to the situation. So the rule just kind of sets out a generic parameter intentionally because they figure it's going to be more discretionary by the court. So it's a lot of court discretion. Why would the plaintiff need to resort to this? So these are two issue spotter questions. Why would you need to do this? Why do you need to get to this route? You would go to this route because what? Yeah.
They've already filed an answer, a motion for summary judgment, and they won't agree to sign.
Perfect. That's the issue spotter points. There's two pieces. You're outside that notice one because they've answered or filed a motion for summary judgment. And they don't want to agree. Okay, if they don't want to agree, realize the court is not going to be really likely to do this, so you need to get there quicker so you can show there's less prejudice to the defendant. And have a good reason why you want out. So if you really think you're going to want out, do it soon. Because then you don't have to ask anybody for permission. All right. There's one other limit in the rule here. One other limit in the rule. Which is when there's been a counterclaim filed in the answer. So let's say all they've done is answered. But they're not going to stipulate. You're at the court. But there's not a whole lot of prejudice to the defendant because it hasn't done. We haven't done much anything other than just file our pleadings. So we're outside the notice parameters because they've answered. They don't want to stipulate because they don't want to. But the court might give it to us. The only caution they have in the rule is the counterclaim has to be able to remain independent for its own adjudication or judgment. Otherwise, we can't dismiss over the defendant's objection. Because now, they've entered the game with a claim. And they have more at stake. So the court cannot dismiss it unless that claim can continue on its own. Yeah?
You said that the document has to be filed. You said that it was a motion for voluntary dismissal or something else.
You typically give a draft order. Like, the court writes the orders. But I'll tell you, in a lot of these things, it's just, this is not in the rules. I'm just trying to tell you in common practice. People file the order as well, so that you can basically just take it and stamp it if it's not a difficult problem. The other thing is you'll typically get, if you get a hearing on this one, you still have the order available. A lot of times, some lawyers make it a common practice to write orders or anything. In the court I worked at, we very rarely use them, but I do know some other courts do sometimes use them. And hey, if you're writing it, you can write it the way you like. So sometimes people draft it. Yeah.
Can you give an example of a counterclaim that wouldn't be able to stand independently and that would be the reason why it's dismissed?
Well, if it's really tied up and bound up with the situation, like a compulsory counterclaim, and it doesn't make sense to do it, it's not so much the rule doesn't require that, but oftentimes that will actually just mitigate against dismissal. It's less that you'll find ones that can't independently stay, but where it's sort of like the court's consideration. And it's the ones that are more compulsory. All right. Or, here's one where it definitely can't, when the statute of limitations will have run if you dismiss at that point on their counterclaim. That's when it definitely can't be independent. All right. Okay. So in all of these, if the order is silent, the presumption is that they're without prejudice. That they're without prejudice. Otherwise, think about it this way. Would you voluntarily dismiss your case as a plaintiff if it was with prejudice? No. So the answer is it's always without prejudice. However, you can change that. Now, you're not going to change it in your notice of dismissal because that's you. You're not going to be like, I'm dismissing my case voluntarily and I don't want to ever file this thing again. But you often do that with stipulation, and that's the settlement thing we're talking about.
okay? Because we don't want to continue. So we might say this is with prejudice. This is a dismissal with prejudice. Settlement always comes with those, along with the contract. The other one that you might have is court order, where they say, you know what, you're right, we're going to grant this, but we think that you've been kind of abusive because you haven't been prosecuting the case like you should, and we're going to make it with prejudice. There's one last other little twist, and that's the notice rule called the two-dismissal rule. So let's focus on that. The two-dismissal rule comes with the notice of dismissal type dismissals, not the stipulations, not the court ones. Realize the court ones and the stipulations could specify with prejudice, but this rule, the two-dismissal rule, is only for notice dismissals. And so here's why. Think about a notice dismissal. First of all, it's noticed by the plaintiff without any approval by the other side or the court. Secondly, we presume them to be without prejudice, meaning he can refile or you could refile as Parsons. So what do you think is the big fear that the rule framers might have in mind if they draft this kind of an operation, a notice dismissal, where you can do it without anybody approving it and you can refile? What do you potentially see as abuse? Remember, you're writing the rules of the game when you're the drafter of the rules. You always want to make sure you don't make the way to just mess the whole game up. Right? The loophole. Test their case out. Not going well. Let's do it again. Not going well again. I'm going to do one more time. Ooh, I really don't like the way that you had that counterclaim. Well, let's do it again. And so we worry about that. This is the two dismissal rule. How do they deal with it? Well, in 41A1B, when it talks about the effect of dismissal, they have this sentence. But if the plaintiff previously dismissed any federal or state court action based on or including the same claim, a notice of dismissal operates as an adjudication on the merits. That's straight from the rule. So that's the last sentence of B, of A1B. Highlight that. And right next to it, two dismissal rule. All right. Colloquially, we call it that. Sometimes you'll even see a court in an opinion refer to it as the two-dismissal rule. If you scour the rules, will you see the words two-dismissal rule written anywhere? No. That's what it is. That's what it is. That last sentence is the two-dismissal rule. Just write it in your rule book. So when you review this, you know what we're talking about. I'm going to move a little CPS thing over the rule language because I know you all have a rule book. So, let's look at our hypothetical, and this is straight from your worksheet. If the plaintiff files in the first suit and files a notice of dismissal and then files the same lawsuit, the same claim in a second suit, and then files a second notice of dismissal, is the second dismissal with prejudice? A yes, B no. Go ahead and look at it. Work with somebody. Click it in. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to click. No, I didn't mean to click already. I'm sorry. I know. But everybody was saying yes, and that is in fact right. And I didn't mean to. I meant to click the timer. So I really apologize for those of you who wanted to click. But I'm really glad to see that those who clicked in early, and there were 30 of you, had it correct. That is right. This one is with prejudice. Why? Look at the rule language and tell me why. Anybody? Now, I know there's like 30 of you who are sharing clickers who came with the right answer, so somebody? Oh, man. It's an adjudication on the merits, and why in this situation is it? What did they do that made it an adjudication on the merits? I'll look back to the rule language there.
Second time they filed it.
Right. They previously dismissed in any federal or state court. There it was. On the same claim. There that is. And now they're using a notice of dismissal to get rid of it. Well, the second notice of dismissal operates as an adjudication on the merits. Let's look at a couple other hypos, and I'll tell you how Ohio uses this rule and how we might see a variation.
It doesn't necessarily seem as the first dismissal has to be a notice dismissal.
Yes, and that's one of the things I'll talk about in a second, because we're going to see that come up, and there's actually a circuit split on it, so hang tight. Okay, here's the next one. They file a notice dismissal, and then they file a second suit, and the second time is dismissal by stipulation. Is the second dismissal one with prejudice? A, yes, it's prejudiced, meaning you can't refile it, it's adjudication on the merits. Or B, no, it's not. Sorry.
I'm going to try and hit the buzzer without messing this one up this time. Okay, 30 seconds. Go ahead and click this one in. This is from your worksheet. Is this one going to trigger the two dismissal rule? And you can already see I like these questions. There's a clear right and wrong. So make sure you know these ones. There's like zero room for discretion. All right. Is this prejudice or not? Oh, God. 48% on yes and 53% on no. And methinks you're guessing. All right. So let's work through the rule because that's like half the class is on either side of the fence. All right. Well, I'll wait to tell you which is the right answer. Hold on. I know, so mean on a Friday. All right, so let's work through it. It says if the plaintiff has previously dismissed any federal or state claim action based on the same claim, got the same claim that we previously dismissed? Okay, so far we're triggering the rule. A notice of dismissal operates as an adjudication of the merits. Have we triggered that part of the rule? No, we haven't. Why not? What have they done? Stipulated. So this is not a two dismissal rule. All right, so here's your second how to issue spot this. You need to think about it with notice of dismissal. But you need to think about it when the notice of dismissal might operate as an adjudication on the merits. Here the question is, does the stipulation operate as an adjudication on the merits? And it doesn't. And you can think about why not policy-wise. So if you can't remember like the technicalities, here's the policy hook. Why do we have the two dismissal rule to begin with? You don't keep refiling, you know, like, oh, I'll just do it again. It's who we worried about. Not you guys. Reckless, right? Okay. So if reckless is agreeing to it, do we have that concern? No. Okay, that's why the stipulation doesn't have that effect. Yes.
So if the first one was stipulation.
Okay, that's not the hypo. Hang on, because that's what he was asking me before, too. Hang tight. Yes. Do you have a question? Oh, okay. Just a high wave. That's all right. Don't worry about it. I have the eagle eye trigger. Anytime I see movement, I'm just like a hawk. I think I saw something move. All right. So no other questions on this one? I can't help it. Sorry. Any other questions on this one? Because we had half the class, half. Did we figure out what it was that you got wrong, if you clicked this one wrong?
Yeah.
Is there anybody else who still has an issue out there with this one? Because I'll tell you, this is the one that I can give you this exact question on the exam, and I will still split the class roughly 60-40 because it's a tricky one to remember. So two things, they'll help you. If you're sort of a technical person, if we're asking about does this give preclusive effect, the thing we're giving preclusive effect has to be a notice of dismissal. Second kind of trigger, it's the policy. So if he's agreeing to it, you're not going to have the concern. Let's look at the next hypo. All right. Here, first suit is in state court by notice of dismissal. Second suit is in federal court by notice of dismissal because I don't want to run out of time. So I want to volunteer as to what this one is. This one is going to be a prejudice one because the rule specifically says that it could be dismissed in state court or in federal court. So notice and then notice again is a problem. Now, I've got to ask twice about what if it was stipulation first and notice second. Well, here's the answer, and it's going to be maybe. All right. In federal courts, they split. There's a split of authority on the result. Half the circuits right now have said a stipulation and then notice of dismissal equals two dismissal rule. Because you're still, like, it just hurts that notice aspect. You can't do notice the second time for those circuits ever. For the other circuits, they say, well, that's not really what the policy's about. The policy's where the plaintiff keeps trying to take another right and act by himself. And so they only do it if you have notice. So half the circuits, or neither half. State of Ohio has a similar rule. In fact, they have a lot of rules that are similar to federal rules, which is why you learned them. One is they are a notice only. Just so you know, if you practice in Ohio, it has to be notice. So a stip, then notice, no two dismissal rule in Ohio. Stip, then notice, half the circuits will say, yep, that's two dismissal. Half the circuits will say, no. Okay? The one that always is notice.
So are we expected to know that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
The federal.
Yeah, and the federal is easy because it's both is right. So that should be an easy one. That's the one you're like, can I know this one? Because the answer is yes either way, right? That's a good one. Anything else? The Ohio one you don't have to know, but just I figured since many of you want to practice on how you might want to know, but I'm not going to touch on that. All right. Go and do well. I'm going to post something this weekend about practice problems up through the final exam and give you old exam questions, so just look for one of my updates.